Hello, everybody, and welcome to Cloud 259, Running on Air. I'm Greg Lemelstein, and with my co-host, Bren Jones. It's November 6th, 2014, and we have episode 31 for you today. Bren, what do we have on today's show?
Well, Greg, of course, we're going to talk about the recently completed New York City Marathon. We're going to kick the show off, though, by talking about the fall marathon season so far. Who were the winners? Who do we think may need better luck next year, and who's been missing in action? Then I'm going to share my interview with Desi Linden that I just completed a few hours ago. What a thrill to talk to basically the second best U.S. marathoner on the women's side right now, and who's there isn't really much of a gap between she and Shalane, Greg. Then we will talk about the New York City race. I'll give you my impressions of being blown around out there in the wind. Afterwards, we'll talk a little bit about our accomplishments of guests and listeners. You're going to climb on the soapbox, I believe, and talk a little bit about race walking. And then that'll be a wrap, Greg. So why don't you get us started with who are the winners from the fall marathon season?
Yeah, so we're basically completed with the major fall marathons. There's a few other marathons to go, Philadelphia in the U.S., and I guess later there's Fukuoka, but basically the big ones are over, and we have a lot of winners. We'll run through them quickly. Cometto's got to top the list with the world record. Enough said on that. But right behind him, Emmanuel Mutai, who didn't win his race in Berlin but ran a 3:03.11 for second place. I'm counting him as a win. I don't care if it was second place. That's just an amazing time, and he's an amazing runner. And Kipsang has got to be the third big international male winner, winning New York in tough conditions and just doing it in style. He had the final kick over De Sisa. He's now won four different majors in his career. And talk about winners, he picks up $600,000 plus whatever appearance fees he had for New York. One international woman is a winner in our eyes. Sara Moreira of Portugal made her debut at New York, and she finished a very strong third in a 2:26 flat, which, considering the conditions, is a great time. She's a track specialist, and that's just an amazing debut on a tough course in the wind. Turning to the Americans, you got to start with Meb as a winner. Another really, really strong, gritty performance, a fourth place at New York. Proving doubters wrong again, even though we promised not to doubt him. We said that he might not be the top American, and we were wrong. We were wrong. On the women's side, Desi, our interview today, really looking forward to hearing that. She was a winner. She had a very, very solid fifth place at New York, a 2:28 in awful conditions, and she just looked rock solid pretty much the whole race. So she's a winner. Earlier in the fall marathon season, Shalane had that awesome 2:21 in Berlin. She was gunning for the American record. She didn't quite get it, but she's now the second fastest American woman ever. Great race by her, proving she's definitely at the top of the American field, maybe just a smidge ahead of Desi. But we'll see about that as it moves forward. Another American, Amy Hastings at Chicago, ran a great race, a 2:27.03, tying her personal best, which might have been excruciating for her, but she's back definitely in the mix for the Olympic marathon. On the men's side, for the Americans, Bobby Curtis ran a 2:11.20 in Chicago, and that's just a big improvement, and it's really about maybe a step forward to even better things for Bobby. We'll keep an eye on him next year. And then we have to mention Fernando Cabada, who at Berlin ran a 2:11.36. So not far behind Bobby Curtis. So those are two names to keep an eye on the sort of second tier of American runners. And then lastly, we got to mention Alana Hadley, 17 years old, ran a 2:38 course record at Indianapolis. And I understand the conditions were windy there as well. So a lot of potential there, and it's coming to fruition already. And then our last guest from last week's show, Tatiana McFadden, wheelchair elite on the women's side, double Grand Slam. If you haven't heard about this, it's just amazing. That's four marathon majors in two consecutive years. She capped it off in New York with the win.
I've got a few to add to that list, Greg. I'll say put Tyler Pinnell on the winner's list. Can't ignore the U.S. winner from the marathon champs here. Big breakthrough for him. Also, Eliud Kipchoge, who took Kenenisa Bekele's scalp in Chicago. And finally, the Hanson's Brooks Distance Project, I'll say, with top two U.S. finishers in the men's race at Chicago, and then with Desi Linden's fifth place finish at New York, the top women's finisher there. As for better luck next year, we mentioned Kenenisa Bekele. I'm not sure he really deserves to be on this list, given that he did run a great race, he just didn't win. But expectations for him are so high that I think he and perhaps others are disappointed that he didn't actually win Chicago, though he did, you know, run a 205 handle. So who am I to say that he should have better luck next year? There's Kara Goucher, who visibly was disappointed by her race at New York. There's Dina Castor, who, though it was a very tough day, and she certainly was upbeat after her race, she wasn't really close to her time target of 2:25. That could be forgiven. She ran 2:33, but perhaps slightly underperformed given her own half marathon performance, which was stronger than that. Rita Jeptu certainly perhaps we'll wait until the appeal on her drug suspension, but better luck maybe in her next career if her B sample comes back positive. Edna Kiplagat has very consistent and strong performer in the past, ran 2:36 at New York. She fell back on the Queensboro Bridge, and though she may win the World Marathon Majors given Jeptu's case, she didn't run basically to her standard at New York. Joffrey Mutai, again, another case where he ran 2:13 blown in the wind in New York. Not a bad time given the conditions, but not what we expect from Mutai. Lisa Uhl, 2:40 at Chicago, not what she was looking for. Matt Lano, 2:17, he was looking to do sub-2:10. And finally, Luc Pousquedre, who actually came in a few ticks behind tonight's guest, Desi Linden. Greg, there are a few missing in action. Who did we not see this fall marathon season?
Well, we didn't see Ryan Hall. He didn't run a fall marathon, and he's looking ahead to next year. But we didn't see a good marathon out of him this year. We haven't for a few years, and hopefully he'll be back at it next year. He said he's back at training, and he's training under Jack Daniels. And so that means he has a coach now. And so anyway, I guess he's in both camps, missing in action and better luck next year. Mm-hmm. A few other top Americans not around in the fall marathon season. Dathan Ritzenhain had some injuries. He moved to Michigan, and I understand he's back training, but not early enough to run a fall marathon. And the other one in a similar situation is Matt Tegenkamp. Now, at the very beginning of the year, we had three picks to PR for 2014, and they were Shalane Flanagan, who did it, Tyler McCandless, who did it, and Matt Tegenkamp, who didn't run a marathon. So it's kind of hard to PR when you don't run, but we understand Matt is back at it and hopefully back on the marathon scene next year.
I believe Matt PR'd in the half this year, but then he got injured. So.
Mm-hmm. And then the last one is Jeffrey Eggleston, who didn't run a fall marathon. He ran Australia in July, a very good time, a 2:10. And he could be running, we're speculating here, but he could be running Fukuoka in a month, which is just before the end of the year. But he wasn't on any of the fall majors. So let's keep an eye on Jeffrey whenever he chooses to toe the line again. He's definitely an up-and-comer, or has already up and came.
Yeah, it was interesting. It was either his Twitter or his Facebook. I think his Facebook feed, there were several people wishing him luck at the New York City Marathon. So even his friends thought he he was going to run there. But he was not in that race. A notable exception, but we're really looking forward to tracking his progress. He's one of those runners who really has a decent shot at one of the top three slots at the Olympic trials. Ryan Hall will be running a race this weekend. He'll be running a 10-miler in Pittsburgh. So moving on, we had the good fortune of speaking with Desi Linden. I conducted the interview a few hours ago, being here in New York. Greg's in London. A little bit easier for me to catch up with Desi. And I was curious to know not only what she thought of this race, but her reflections on that great Boston Marathon in 2011 when she ran 2:22:38, was just a few ticks from winning. And I wanted to hear a little bit about the Hanson's Brooks Distance Project. So here's the interview. Desiree Linden, our guest tonight, is coming off a fifth-place finish at the New York City Marathon this past weekend in 2 hours, 28 minutes, and 11 seconds, which is a time faster, by the way, than the winning time in 2010. A native of Chula Vista, California, Desi trains in Rochester Hills, Michigan with the Hanson's Brooks Distance Project. We'll talk about them a little bit in our interview. Her track PRs include 15:08 for the 5K, 31:37 for the 10K, and she's run a 1:10:33 for the half marathon. But perhaps Desi's best known for the awesome 2011 Boston Marathon, in which she came through in 2 hours, 22 minutes, and 38 seconds, just 2 seconds behind the winner in a runner-up finish that established her as one of the world's best marathoners. Desi, welcome to Cloud 259.
Thanks for having me. Excited to chat.
Desi, I was there in the race at New York running well behind you, but I had a few questions about your race. I'll break it into three segments. First off, when you first started running on the Verrazano Bridge and felt that wind, tell me in three words or less what you were thinking.
Oh, my God. Does that work?
That definitely works. So expand on that a little. You can use more than three words now. Expand on that. So were you expecting the rest of the race to be like that? I know it really calmed down after, to a certain extent, after you get off the bridge. But the bridge was something, huh?
It was. And actually, I said, oh, my God. And then it was kind of logical after that. If you can get through this part, it's going to get better the rest of the day. So it was just sort of be patient, relax, and it kind of kept you in check early so you didn't make any dumb decisions in that real early excitement of the race. So it wasn't the worst thing, but it was kind of shocking at first.
Right, right. When I was running, it seemed most of the runners were trying to tuck in on the right side of the bridge. Was that the case as well with the women up there?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, we strung out in quite a long line. I was kind of surprised that it wasn't more across and tucking in on the right, but it worked well for me. I just found the tallest woman, Yelena, from Latvia, and I was her best friend for pretty much as long as I could be on the day.
Good strategy. And I saw you had the long sleeve shirt on as well, eh? So you had that on for about 5 or 6 miles, is that right?
Yeah, it was quite a ways. I thought I didn't think I would even have it on that long. Once the sun came out, it did change quite a bit. You'd get a little bit of sunshine out there, and then you'd warm up pretty good. So when I ditched it, I was pretty comfortable the rest of the morning.
Right, right. The part of the race that was somewhat frustrating for us viewers, because we, on television anyway, we couldn't see the whole thing. I couldn't see the whole thing in the replay. But that seemed like a very crucial part of the race for you was First Avenue and up into the Bronx. The way Greg put it was you were sort of bobbing and weaving on First Avenue, trying to stay in it. Can you tell us from your perspective what that part of the race was like?
Mm-hmm. I felt pretty good there. And actually one of the big things that I need to work on and I probably had trouble with was that a lot of the fluid stations, I would lose 3-4 steps on the group. Mm-hmm. And that kind of happened around that time period. And so I caught back up to the group, and I think right when I caught back up to them, they picked it up that next mile. I think it just took that little bit extra out of me. Mm-hmm. And then once you fell off that pack, the effort just got so much more difficult with the wind. So I think that kind of did me in. And nothing drastic really happened at that point, but I think a lot of that regrouping and catching back up kind of just took it out of me at that point.
Mm-hmm. And was there a moment when you sort of thought to yourself, I'm going to stick with the group? Or was there a moment you thought to yourself when I'm going to let them go and regroup and maybe I'll catch them, you know, going into Manhattan?
I was digging down and trying to catch back up because I knew the effort was going to be so much more difficult.
Right.
And especially with the left-hand turn, when you go, I guess it's into the Bronx, that wind, I think that was probably the worst of the day. So I really wanted to be on that group. I just didn't have it at that point. But I didn't feel like I was completely blowing up. I actually felt like they stepped on the gas a little bit.
Right.
So I knew that there could be carnage coming back, and I just had to kind of keep, you know, running as hard as I could, even with the wind coming up.
Right. The Bronx tore me to shreds. That was definitely the toughest part of the race for me. But yeah, and you know, the last part of the race that I wanted to touch upon was from 40K to the finish. You caught and passed two runners, including the 2011 champ Fiery Wat Dato. Can you take us through that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess going down Fifth Avenue, is that when you're heading back towards the park?
Yeah.
I saw Kevin Hansen, he's out there cheering, and he's like, you're doing so great, like, you can catch people. And I looked up, and I was like, out of his mind, there's no one up there, I'm not going to catch anybody. And it was Central Park South where I first saw Dato, and I was like, oh, I can catch her.
Uh-huh.
And then at Columbus Circle, I saw the last woman. So it was very, very late. But I definitely dug down and had, like, the kick of my life. And my calves were cramping, my hamstrings were cramping, my feet were cramping, and I was ready to be finished. But I had to get all the way through the line on that one.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Well, that was a great kick, and that was captured on Instagram, so people on Twitter can find that. Yeah, it was a nice kick. Well, it was very inspiring, and I think that more than one commentator has called you a badass, and it was quite a badass move at the end there.
That's a good compliment.
Yeah. Were there any other particular highs or lows or memorable images from the race that strike you?
I mean, being on the bridge and at the start, it was obviously, like, you knew it was going to be a challenging day in the whole thing, but it was really cool, like, kind of a special moment where you're like, they shut down the streets of New York City so we can go run as fast as we can from A to B, and, you know, you always forget about that, and you look behind you, and you see this huge mass of people, and it's pretty special to just be there on the day and get the opportunity to do that. So I always like to take a moment, kind of stop, smile, and appreciate it, and then go and inflict the pain. So that's always good.
Mm-hmm. Was it your first time running, certainly your first time running the entire course? Had you trained on any parts of the course before?
I did. I was out there in June after the New York Mini, and covered the whole thing over 2 or 3 days. So got to see it and knew it would be challenging.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I definitely took that into training with me, like knowing the course was going to be very difficult and I'd probably have to work a little bit harder even when the effort felt like I was working hard. I knew I needed to be working just a little bit harder. So.
Mm-hmm. One last question on that race itself and on the apparel. You were wearing your signature sunglasses, and I thought it was interesting that it seemed most people were bracing for the cold, and it seemed like you were staying cool in those sunglasses. Is that just because you like to wear them, or is there a particular advantage, do you think, it gives you? I know the sun actually doesn't help a marathoner so much.
Mm-hmm. I've just gotten used to it over the years. My vision's actually pretty horrible, and I feel like I'm just saving my eyes. And I went to school in Phoenix, so it was like you wore sunglasses pretty much every day. So it's kind of like just the comfort zone more than anything. And Oakley's a good sponsor, and they hook me up with really cool stuff, so
right.
It makes it easy to wear.
Right. Shortly before the marathon, the day before, in fact, I think news broke that Rita Jeptu, who's dominated marathon majors over the past few years, had a sample come back positive for EPO. What was the buzz among the elite women about that?
Honestly, at that point, I mean, we did our press conference the day before, so we didn't have any clue, and I never really got feedback from the athletes running the race. I think there was... I mean, for myself, it was like you're upset, you're frustrated, but you're also worried about the task. So,
right.
You know, you set all that emotion aside and, like, you can think about it later. For me, it was just like, okay, this doesn't change my day. I'm worried about myself and what I'm going to do tomorrow. So,
right. Right. Well, we're all for a clean sport here. it's pretty shocking when sort of the top of the totem pole comes out with a positive drug test. We'll see where that story goes. It's been a good fall for the Hanson's Brooks Distance Project. Great performances, not only by you, but also at Chicago by Bobby Curtis and Jake Riley. Can you outline in general the Hanson's method for those who are unfamiliar with it?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing for our marathon training is what they refer to as cumulative fatigue. And that's basically just building up mileage week after week. And, you know, when you get to that point where you're like, man, I'm really tired, I need to freshen up my legs, you learn to push through it, obviously not to the point where you're injured, but where you learn to run marathon pace or just quicker than on really tired legs. And then at the end of this, you know, 10, 12 week block, you dial it back just a little bit for the taper, and all of a sudden your legs, you know, you're fresh and that pace is sustainable through a whole marathon.
So in the training itself, what would be an example of a way that you would sort of get your legs to be really fatigued and then do a, you know, a marathon paced run on that? It would be a marathon paced run after a huge mileage day, or could you give us more specifics there?
Sure. I think it's just a string of weeks together. Like for me, I'll hit 120, you know, 2-3 weeks in a row and be doing marathon paced workouts, like 3x3 miles at race pace, and then 2 days recovery of, you know, 14 miles in the morning, 4 in the afternoon, 12 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon, and then another big workout, and then a long run after, you know. So it starts just adding up. There's not one single day that's necessarily especially difficult that tires your legs out. It's just a day after day grind, I guess you would say. Mm-hmm. So it's, and you get to the point where you're like, man, I really want to freshen up. I want to take a day off. Or, you know, I want to take that 10-mile day, but it's just kind of continuous. And you learn how to run through that dead leg feeling that you kind of get at the end of the marathon.
Yeah, we had Dot McMahon on the show last year, and, you know, she's run with Brooks, and she told us that, you know, after she starts marathon training, she doesn't feel fresh again until race morning. So I guess if you time it right, you must feel really dynamite on the race morning after all that hard training.
Yeah, it's a weird thing because even when you don't feel phenomenal, you've trained your body to run when you're really tired. So it's like, it's not really the end of the world if you don't feel really fresh. You're like, well, I train on tired legs, so this is just fine. But we do dial it back enough where you can get that fresher feeling, unless we just taper on. But I think we have it pretty pinned down right now. So.
Back in 2007, you ran the Boston Marathon in 2 hours, 44 minutes, and 56 seconds. Now, that was your first marathon, right?
Correct.
What are your memories from that race?
Similar weather, I guess, to New York this year. It was the nor'easter. I remember them being on the bubble of canceling it. And I, as far as the race go, I had a blast. Like, it was pouring rain, it was headwinds, and I was probably the only person out there that really enjoyed it. I loved every step, and I was like, the crowds were awesome. It was so much fun covering the distance. I had a bunch of teammates out there at race that day too. I finished, you know, across the finish line. I was like, I can't wait to do that again. I'm not sure if I was the only person thinking that, but I kind of fell in love with the marathon that day.
And then 4 years later, when you took about a minute a mile off that time with a 2:22:38, were you as surprised at that performance as everybody else, or were you confident by that point that sort of thing was within you?
I felt really ready to go, and I knew I was ready for a big day. Obviously, you can't control what anybody else in the field does if someone goes out and runs, you know, 2:19, I wasn't ready for that, but I knew I could compete well, so I wasn't shocked by it. I knew that I had a shot to win, and so I felt like I raced like that all day, and actually, I think if I hadn't prepared myself mentally for that, I would have gotten those later stages, and then I thought, I don't think I belong here. I maybe been a little more tentative, so I was glad that I did feel prepared for that.
Do you remember clearly the, you know, the finishing stretch there, the last, you know, 100 or 200 meters? It was such an incredible race to watch on TV, and I was particularly struck at how you had one last late move and took the lead quite late.
Yeah, it was definitely one of those battles where you're like, okay, this is it. This is going to be the move that breaks her, and like, this is where I'm running away with it. And then your legs would cramp up, and you'd be like, oh, no, wait, like, I got to hold off just a little bit. And then she would go by, and you'd be like, oh, I'm done. And, you know, your legs would freshen up just for a second. And you just kind of, I think we were probably both doing the exact same thing. And she just got the upper hand right at the end. So, but it was fun. That's what you want a race to be. And that's what's exciting about it and makes it interesting. It makes it more of a chess match versus just watching checkers. So it was fun to be a part of.
Right. My co-host Greg wants to know, how you would compare what is more impressive to you, your 228 into a big headwind here in New York City or your 222 with a big tailwind in Boston?
That's a good question. I don't know how those average out. I would say my 222 simply because I was competing. I don't ever really, when I think about the race, I don't really look at the time. I'm just like, I was second in a really close race. And
right.
To me, that's obviously the more impressive thing. So, I would go with that for now.
Right. It was interesting to me, though, looking back at prior years of New York, how your time this year actually was faster than the winning time in 2010 in New York. There are far better conditions there, and the winner was Edna Kiplagat, and Shalane Flanagan was second, and this year's winner, Mary Cattaney, was third. So you got all of them.
That's right. I remember that year. I remember watching. Very tactical.
Yeah. But still, I think the women at New York this year deserve a ton of credit because the times really weren't that far off the norm. I think it was a lot of impressive running. I was
fairly surprised by the pace given the conditions. I thought it was pretty honest for what we were facing. So it was a good day.
Yeah. There's a woman who has a great running blog called raceslikeagirl.com, a woman named Julie Threlkeld, and she's a big fan of yours, and she did a great recap of that Boston race in 2011. She has a question, when are you going to run London? And I'll add to that question, given that the tweet came out today about how, from Hanson's Brooks, about how you've now had a top five finish in four of the six world marathon majors, those being Boston, Berlin, Chicago, and New York. Not only when are you going to run London, but when are you going to run Tokyo?
Yeah, that's a good question. I do want to one day do all the majors. I think that would be really cool, and they all have something really unique. I got to get some speed in my legs to do London to make it useful for me, and I don't have that right now. So I think next year is going to be about rebuilding speed and getting ready for the trials, and maybe after the 2016 games, maybe the 2017, I'll look at it, but definitely not before then. I got to get quick.
Do you think you'll get back on the track next year?
Yes, absolutely. We'll definitely incorporate a good amount of speed work and hopefully take a stab at some track PRs. I think that might be a little bit difficult just because I haven't done the track stuff in so long, but if I can start edging towards them, and maybe next year, in a year or so, I can get right back to where I was.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it'd be great to see you in a 5K or 10K. Get those times down with the way exactly. that you kicked it, New York. Your competition should be a little worried. Regarding your competition, clearly right now, if we look at the 2016 Olympic team, Shalane Flanagan and then yourself would be the favorites to make the team. You never know what's going to happen in a marathon. The third slot's a little fuzzier. But do you see Shalane as sort of a big rival? Or is she just one of many of the, international elites? Not that many, but the international elites that you're just vying to win these races against?
Yeah, I think definitely in the major races, and it's international, it's just like one other competitor.
Uh-huh.
It's nice to have another American up there that you can kind of keep an eye on. And, if she has a good day, she's going to succeed for Americans. And then that raises the bar for everyone. But as far as like feeling an extra special rivalry towards her, it's not, because pretty much she's beat me every time out. But you know, I'm going to keep chasing her down just like everyone else as I try and win one of these majors.
Right. Right. Speaking of rivals, Greg has another good question. Your husband, Ryan, is a runner turned triathlete who has a 2:26 marathon PR. Could you take him down in a race of any distance right now, as long as there's no bike or swim?
Of any distance? Yes, for sure. I'm just going to be full on cocky about it, because like my favorite thing in the world is to pick on Ryan. Because Ryan just like takes it in stride and he'll laugh and be like, whatever.
Julie had one more question. You've got a lot of chapters left to write in your career, but she was curious about what you had in mind for when your running career is over. Do you think that you'll be in the coaching and or something else?
Yeah, that's a good question. And actually, my sister and I just right now have started this new thing called 360 Elite Endurance, and mm-hmm. we're looking at making training plans for a wide variety of people looking to get either fit or actually train for an event. And so I think that will be something that we build while I'm finishing up my career, and hopefully it's something I can get more involved in as I, you know, move on for once I've retired, and then just a plotter.
Mm-hmm. Help other people get fast.
Absolutely.
Well, it sounds good to me. And you mentioned training plans, and one lesson I had from this race was that a marathon performance is likely to reflect the training. It's hard to overachieve in a marathon if your training isn't quite there. And I'll use this to segue to your injury. You know, you qualified for the Olympics for London, and then you had a stress fracture. It sounds very painful. Femoral shaft. And I was curious, sometimes in rehabilitation, people do the kind of work that they never had done before. And was that the case with you? Like, did you do some strength training that you hadn't done before when you were rehabbing from your injury? And what role does that sort of rehabilitation work, or maybe non-running training, have in your training now?
Mm-hmm. I did do different strengths, and it was more like, I guess, getting the muscles firing correctly, sequencing type thing. I went and saw John Ball out in Phoenix, and he worked with me quite a bit, just pinpointing a lot of weaknesses and areas I needed to get fixed up. And so he basically would send me updated programs every couple weeks, and it was new and it was different, but it was very specific to, you know, the weaknesses that I developed because of this injury, or, you know, had and caused the injury. So that was definitely something new, and it's something that I've gotten away from a little bit because I've been healthy for a while, so I'm just a little lazy about it now, which is on my list of things to get better at. But it is important, and I felt like it did make a huge difference in helping me come back. And then beyond that, I try and do yoga fairly often when I get into the routine of it. I really enjoy that, and I think it's just a good general strengthening, and flexibility is never a bad thing. So I like that part as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, at the Olympics, did you think at the start line that it was a long shot that race would go well?
I did, yeah. I mean, on the line, it was really frustrating because at that point I didn't know what the injury was. Uh-huh. The doctors were like, I think it's just, tendonitis. Like, we don't see anything. Basically, they missed the stress fracture by like an inch or something on the MRI, so... So like, it's probably just tendonitis. So to me, that's something that you can kind of work through. Like, okay, maybe it'll warm up. Like, I'm just going to go mile by mile. Probably not going to be the greatest race in my career, but you want to cross the finish line. So I got out there and just tried to do that. And the first, like, hard right turn, you could tell it wasn't going to happen. And then you think about all the turns that were on the course, because uh-huh. that was the big thing with the course is like there's like 90 turns over the whole 26.2. I don't know how many there were, but there was a ton. So that first hard right turn, I was like, this is going to be bad, and this isn't this isn't going to warm up and suddenly be better. So I just, you know, made the call early on, which was frustrating, but it happens.
Well, it was such an impressive race that got you onto the Olympic team, your second place finish at the trials in Houston. And, of course, you'll have another go at it in how many months now? Is it 15 months or something in 2016?
Coming up very quick, yeah.
I want to get sort of to just a few more questions. A great deal of hard work goes into being an elite distance runner, particularly in returning from injury, but just at your level. I think there must be times, and particularly with what you've described of the Hansen's method, where you really have to dig deep and do things that don't feel natural in a way, like, you know, run when you're completely shattered. I could see how success is a great motivator, but are there other things that you call upon for motivation or inspiration to get through that really hard work of training?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question, and I think one of the big things is I'm lucky enough to be on a team. And it's nice to see everyone out there on those really crummy days where you don't want to be out working hard and you see your teammates doing it. And
right.
You see them trying to get better. And we're all just trying to get the best out of ourselves. And that's super inspiring. The amount of time Kevin and Keith put into the program and our assistant Don Jackson, I mean, they're out there all the time. They're on the road all the time. And, you know, it's sometimes you work for the people that are in your team. I know my husband, Ryan, puts up with me in the middle of those 120-mile weeks when I'm super grumpy. And so, you know, I do it for him, too. And it's just that whole group and team that you have that gets you out there, you know, on the days when it's not necessarily easy. It's easy to look to teammates and the people that are supporting you and remember why you're doing what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. And you've recently added some depth on the women's side, right, with Callie McCumber and Megan Gethels. Do you think we'll see them mixing it up in a marathon major or U.S. champs anytime soon?
They certainly are capable. We have Callie, Megan, and Katie Kellner, who's from Cornell, mm-hmm. who are all Callie's a little beat up right now, but the other two are running very well, and it's such a tricky time when you first get here because you're getting used to higher mileage and training with training partners who can kind of beat up on you a little bit and the whole thing, you know, it's the new training system. But if they're in it for the long haul and they put the work in and stay healthy, they're certainly capable. So I think they'll both do really well, and then Callie will, I'm sure, follow in their footsteps.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks, Desi, so much for your time. We have one last question. The name of our site and podcast is Cloud 259, because when Greg and I started this, we were both 308 marathoners, and we figured if we broke 3 hours, we would hit Cloud 259. So one question we have for everybody, for all of our guests, I should say, is that if you could give one tip, a training tip or a race day tip, for how to help runners not only break 3 hours, if that's their goal, but to achieve a PR, any PR in the marathon, what would that one tip be?
I think the one tip would be love the process. And, you know, it's in training and in racing. I think we all have moments where it hurts, but you just got to smile and remember that what you're doing is fun. The steps that hurt, you've actually earned, because you have to push yourself really hard. So smile at the pain, know that you've worked really hard to get there, and then just keep on fighting through it and sort of love that process. So that would be my tip.
Fantastic. Fantastic tip. Thank you so much, Desi.
All right. Thank you. Have
okay.
a good one.
You too. Bye now. So that was my interview with Desi Linden. Interestingly, I think initially right after New York, right after the race, she wasn't thrilled with her race, but a day or two later, through the social media, it seems like she became more happy with it. One reason perhaps is that the TV announcers at first told her that she came in sixth place, when in fact she finished fifth. And Desi's not afraid to aim high. She said before the race that, you know, her goal was top three or top five, and if she was in the mix to win it, she wouldn't be afraid to mix it up. I like that about her, and she's earned it. She's very quietly risen to the top ranks, not only of American Marathon, but really she's a threat to win any of the World Marathon majors that she's entered in. So what a thrill to speak with her, and hopefully we'll be talking with her again if she cracks the Olympic team if we get a chance to otherwise.
Yeah, she basically does not have a bad race. I mean, she went through the injury problems and coming back from injuries. She had a Berlin time that was not indicative of her talent, but she was coming back from injury. So based on where her fitness is, I just have not seen her have a bad race at the marathon distance. It's amazing. She's rock solid.
Yeah. I like the, how Hansen had pointed out over Twitter how she had now notched a top five finish in four of the World Marathon majors. And it was neat during the interview to hear that she did plan at some point to run London and Tokyo to get all of them.
Very cool.
To get all of them done.
So, Bryn, on the elite scene, let's keep the focus on New York. What else were some big takeaways for you watching the race? Well, not watching the race, but perhaps reviewing it afterwards after your race was done.
It was interesting. Clearly, since I ran the race, I didn't watch it live while it was happening, except from within, and I certainly didn't see the pros, except to the very beginning when I was waiting on the bridge and I saw the heads of the women run by. I watched the race, the replay on ESPN3. First off, clearly the coverage that was there was okay, but a lot of it wasn't covered because they had trouble either getting in touch with the Tony Revis or Paula Radcliffe, who were sort of on the lead bicycles, they completely lost the men's feed at a crucial moment. To his credit, Tim Hutchings, who has a Twitter feed, wrote that he clearly understood that a lot of people were frustrated. He was doing some of the play-by-play in the race.
We don't want understanding. We want the feed.
Yeah. Now, the race itself, one thing I haven't really seen brought up in the running media that struck me was that for the women's race, it actually was a fairly honest pace. So I mentioned in my interview with Desi, but her time of 2:28 was actually 2:28.11 was faster than the women's time, the women's winner from 2010, where the conditions were a lot better. In that race, Edna Kiplagat won. Shalane Flanagan, memorably, was second. That was her marathon debut. And Mary Cattaney was third. And Desi's time actually was faster than all of their times. And I think that was because of the Portuguese runner, Sara Moreira, is that her name? Who came in third. She was leading much of the way. And I was thinking, who is this Sara person? But she kept the pace pretty honest. The winning time, Mary Cattaney's 2:25.07, I believe, was exactly the same as the winning time last year. Whereas on the men's side, I got the impression that there was more holding back among the leaders. And the final straightaway, I mean, both races, you had very close races, but in the men's race, the final straightaway, you saw such a contrast where Kipsang was very smooth, and I would have loved to have seen this live, not knowing that he had won, because Lalisa De Sissa, Greg, who you had picked to win, had a very contrasting style. He was all over the place, but he was clearly working, and we know that he's got good finishing speed. He's won Dubai and Boston before. The commentators, and perhaps I would have thought at one moment that maybe De Sissa was going to pull it out. And then when De Sissa sort of elbowed Kipsang, and then Kipsang just looked at him and then just floated away, that was a pretty good moment in marathon history, I think. And we had Andy Kiss, who was stationed in the park, and he got a shot, not of that moment, but another moment when Kipsang was looking at De Sissa, like, you know, sort of a what's you talking about, Willis kind of moment. Was a great, great photo. Please check out our photo gallery on our Facebook or on our webpage, cloud259.com, to have a look at that. Great shot by Andy.
Yeah, that was definitely the moment of the image of the race. And then the way, the grace with which he sped away. It wasn't like you could see him switching gears. He just floated away, but floating at like, 60-second quarter mile pace or something crazy on that last uphill section.
Yeah,
De Sissa does have great form, by the way. But he was just giving it his all, and it was all sort of falling apart with his arms. But he's he's got excellent form. Normally, not at that moment.
Yeah, DeCisa and Sumgong, both the second place finishers. At some point, you could tell they capitulated because they had just been passed, and then they looked behind them.
Yep.
So
yep.
You knew that they were cooked. And what an inopportune time! I mean, it was nice that the feed was back in time for the very finish, but what an inopportune time to lose it on the men's side of the race, because Meb was still in the lead, I believe, or in that front pack when they basically stopped covering the men's race. And there's the drama for a lot of American marathon fans: is Meb going to be able to hold it? We didn't get to see him crack, or even to see him come back. If we were in charge of this marathon coverage, Greg, televised coverage, I think perhaps we would have had a separate camera on the lead American and, to see what was going on with him throughout the race.
Right. So you pointed out the image of the race, but the second and third big images that I'm left with from that race both involve Meb. One was just coming off the 59th Street Bridge, the big classic tunnel of noise that begins the First Avenue section of the race. Meb took the lead right at that point, and the crowd went wild, as they should.
Mm-hmm.
And, I kind of thought it was Meb trying to get the crowd going so he could get himself going. But afterwards, he said he was it was a tactic to slow down the pace. He went to the front to prevent anyone from a lot of time there are surges on First Avenue. Years ago, Hendrik Romalo was famous for taking off and going nuts with a 420 mile or something on First Avenue. He wanted to keep it contained. And so he was basically orchestrating the field there, not playing to the crowd. But it was just a really vivid moment. The other one, and I don't know if anybody caught this, but after when Meb was coming in to the finish in his fourth place, about less than 100 meters from the finish, DeCisa, with his Ethiopian flag wrapped around him, gives Meb a high five. Meb wasn't even done with the race, and they high-fived each other. And that just shows you how Meb has really transcended the world. He's just everyone's a fan, even DeCisa, who had just lost a battle with Kipsang. I thought that was a cool moment.
Yeah, interesting. And I didn't really see any hugs or congratulations from DeCisa to Kipsang, so that he gave Meb a high five is
exactly. Yeah, that was cool. And then I'll throw in my the tweet of the day was a pre-race tweet when everyone's focused on the wind and you're hearing all these reports and you hear that the wheelchair athletes are starting on the other side of the Verrazano and the elite tent got knocked over. House of Run tweeted about Luc Pescedra, who, if listeners don't know, is 6'4" and a half and maybe 95 pounds. No, I'm exaggerating. But House of Run tweeted, Luc Pescedra might blow into the Hudson for this one. I thought that was hilarious.
You know, Greg, I felt the same. Maybe Luke and I had the same problem. Not enough muscle. Too thin.
Yeah,
in the race, also in the lead at one point, Yuki Kawauchi sure gave a few fans a thrill. He took the lead at a moment. Nick Arseniaga was in the lead briefly. And Imai, the other Japanese runner, his first name escapes me, but he was in the lead on First Avenue at some point. So there were times it was interesting on the men's side before the main break, which we did not see because it wasn't always Mutai and Kipsang in the lead. And in fact, Kipsang, I think, didn't lead until quite late in the race.
Yeah, usually we've seen the opposite in recent years. You've seen men's races go out hard the whole way and women's races being more tactical. And so I guess it was the opposite, as you say. But that's kind of masked by the windy conditions, which didn't produce extraordinarily fast times for the women. But relative to other races, they were working harder earlier.
So, Greg, do you want to run down a list? We had some of our listeners and guests on the show who performed well. I'll take the cream of the crop here. A huge, huge tip of the hat to Alan Rubin, our teammate on the Central Park Track Club. We had Alan on the show on episode 16. He has an amazing streak. It was 24 years. It's now 25 consecutive races, I should say, at the New York City Marathon, where he has broken 3 hours. The conditions were really tough. Times were slow across the board. except for a few brave souls. One of them was Alan. He squeaked under 3 hours yet again. At the age of 57, he ran 2 hours, 59 minutes, and 49 seconds. So just by 11 seconds, he got under 3 hours. He credits a teammate of ours, Chris Solaris, for helping him out in the last few miles. Alan actually had to walk several times late in the race because he had some cramps in his legs. But he got it done, Greg. 27th consecutive New York City Marathon form and 25th consecutive sub-3-hour finish.
Amazing. I'm looking ahead to hearing your race and whether you saw Alan on the course. But let's just finish up some of the team members we have on the Strava. We have a Cloud 259 team, and please join. We have an amazingly international group of runners who we follow in their workouts. Chris Donnelly, another teammate at Central Park Track Club, ran a 3:16 at New York, and that's not a PR for him, but it's a great performance. In my eyes, but I wanted to mention that the last three marathons he's entered have been the Super Hot Boston, which you and I DNF'd Bren in, the Super Storm Sandy canceled New York City Marathon, and now the Super Windy New York. So he hasn't had much luck. I'm sure there are a lot of people like him who have entered all those races and have had to deal with either bad conditions or no race. Better luck next time, Chris. Your luck will turn, I promise. Another Cloud 259 team member, Gareth Herford from Manchester, going the opposite direction than we did earlier in the year. So going from Manchester to New York, and he ran a 3:25 in New York, a fine time. Congrats, Gareth. And then before New York, 6 days earlier in Dublin, the Dublin Marathon is always run on a Monday. Sean Cullen is on Cloud 248 in his marathon debut, which is amazing. He's a talented one. So he'll make the Wall of Honor on our website. We'll put the time up there. Sean credits that word we've been using a lot lately, patience, for his great performance. He was actually looking for a low 240 performance, and he said if the stars were all aligned, perhaps a sub 240. But there were tough conditions in Dublin as well. Seems like it's happened all over the world in a lot of the fall marathons. But it was windy and warm and humid in Dublin on race day.
It's a bad combo.
So So I think what Sean credited was patience, and he adjusted his goals after the first few miles of just and running by feel, because he wanted to finish strong. He said he did. Leak some minutes towards the end, but couldn't have been that bad if he put up a great 2:48. So congrats, Sean. And then one other person in Dublin from our Cloud 259 team, Warren Donnelly, no relation to our Chris here in New York, ran a 3:07:49 in Dublin. And when I went to look for his time, I noticed there were 31 Donnellys who finished the Dublin Marathon. Maybe not a surprise, that's a common name there. But as an aside, there were also 31 named Hughes from the same family. And you may have heard about this, Bren, but they set the Guinness World Record for most family members to finish the same marathon. 31 family members named Hughes. There were actually 66 Hugheses in the race, but 35 of them, I guess, were no relation, at least not a close relation.
Wow, a lot of 31s there. Given it's episode 31, it's fitting, right?
That's right, good point. Also, and I would say the maximum number of Lemos Steins would be one, because no one in my family even understands why I run marathons. I don't know how many Joneses could do it. I know your sister could do it.
So yeah, in my family, I'd say, well, two currently. and a hats off to my sister, Polly, who had been put in a great block of training, was looking to reach Cloud 3:59, but the conditions sort of threw that out the window. Still, she came through in 4:20 and set a PR for her on that course. So she ran faster now than she did as a 27-year-old. Now she's 39. Congrats to Polly. I was thrilled to see that she finished strong and nipped under her New York City PR. So great job to Polly.
All right, Bren, you've stalled enough. I want to hear your race. I want to hear how it went. You went in slightly underprepared, just maybe in one respect, with fewer long runs than you would want to do. But life intervenes, and you couldn't get out there for as many 20-milers as we know we should do. But how did it feel?
Well, Let's just say that it was another one of my medical tent races. After the race, I had a moment of clarity, and I thought, this event is for total masochists. This event today, this marathon, perhaps this sport, is for masochists. And I was in the medical tent getting great care, mind you. The New York City Marathon medical tent is a good place to be after the race. I recommend it for people who aren't feeling right at the end of the race. And
yeah,
I
didn't even know you were in the tent. We've been so busy. I haven't you've caught up a little bit, but I didn't even know this was another tent race for you. So tents and total races?
I've started about 8 marathons or maybe, 8 marathons, including Boston. So Boston, I made a point not to go to the medical tent. I didn't at the finish. I didn't want to go to the medical tent, but I did actually duck into one during the race when I ducked off the course, of course.
Was the finish for you that day?
My sub-3, that's right. My sub-3 races, I didn't go into the medical tent, though there was that nice hospitality tent in Manchester that we used.
That was a massage. That doesn't count. That's
okay.
Massage.
But sub-3 at New York last year, no medical tent. And I did not use a medical tent after Brooklyn. I think I slowed up enough for the last 6 miles of that one. I was practically walking the last 6 miles, so perhaps I didn't need it for that reason. It hardened my belief, actually. It confirmed my belief, this New York City Marathon, that you really... though it's possible to have a disappointing race off of a great block of training, you're very unlikely to overachieve when you're undertrained. So I learned this race reflected my training, I think. So, one could complain about the weather was not ideal for sure. But even in ideal conditions, I don't think I would have broken 3. I'll tell you I looked back at my training for New York, and last year in the 10 weeks prior to the race, I averaged over 60 miles a week. This year in the 10 weeks prior to the race, I averaged, I think, 45 to 50 miles a week. So the volume was down. I was down considerably. Last year before New York, I had a 12-mile, a 15.5-mile, and an 18-mile run all at marathon pace. So I had 3 really solid marathon pace workouts. This year I topped out at 8 miles at marathon pace. I had a bit of hope because I had had some pretty good race experiences this fall in the 1.5-mile marathon. But as I've learned in the past, those races don't really tell you that much about a full marathon. A half marathon tells you more than a mile does, but still, a full marathon is a completely different race from a half marathon. So as to the race itself, Greg, the wind was completely ridiculous on the Verrazano. So right off the bat, you knew that conditions might totally mess up the day. Though I'll say once we got off the Verrazano, it did calm down a lot for that stretch in Brooklyn. I was not able to get into any kind of rhythm going up the Verrazano. Right at the beginning of the race, what I try to think about a lot is just form, getting into a bit of a flow. And the wind it almost did blow me off the bridge. It was blowing people around all over the place. Coming off the bridge, I was able to get into a flow, and at the 5K, my time was similar to last year. So I thought, okay, I don't feel great, but I had a little bit of a stomach problem, but I don't feel lousy either. I do feel like I was holding back. And then I continued, through the first half of the race, I was in a little bit of a flow. I didn't feel great, but I did feel like I was holding back. I think that's just basically how it was. And the difference is last year when I was far better trained, when I was better prepared for the race, I started to feel stronger and my mile splits came down in post Fourth Avenue section. So from basically mile 8 to mile 15, I was gaining strength. And this year I was maintaining my pace, but I wasn't gaining strength in that time. And I went back and forth with the 3-hour pace group a bit. This year I passed them, the 3-hour pace group, in Williamsburg, maybe. Yeah,
just before halfway? I'm trying to recall now.
Yeah, before the halfway point, but it was much later. Last year, I passed the three-hour pace group on the way up on Lafayette, so I think mile 8 to mile 9. This year, it was more like, yeah, mile 12. I passed, and then they passed me right back.
And then at 20K, your projected time on the race tracker was 3 hours and 3 seconds. Huh. 3:00:03, which would have been cool, by the way, if you'd had a 3:00.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, and I thought about that. And that's, I talk a lot about, you know, sort of being, emptying your mind during the race. You're not having too much going on there. And when I was talking to Polly about the race beforehand, I was trying to, you know, tell her to, you know, don't get too caught up in the time goal and yada, yada, yada. But it was, for me, 3 hours was a thing for me in this race. By the time we got nearly halfway through, or by the time I was halfway through, sort of before I got to the Queensboro, I was thinking, okay, I don't think I'm going to get a PR today. I was pretty clear. It was pretty clear to me I wasn't going to get a PR. When I saw the split at the halfway mark, which is 1:30 something and change, I thought, okay, I'm not going to get a PR. I'm not going to get 2:56. But 3 is still a possibility, particularly because I'm near the 3-hour pace group. So then I tried running with the 3-hour pace group for a bit. Then we got to the Queensboro, and going up the bridge, I fell back. I was passed by people, and I thought, uh-oh, this isn't good, because last year I was just creaming people up this bridge, and now I'm getting passed. And so I had a bit of a moment of, okay, I'm just going to let go of the goal and just, you know, see what happens. And I told myself, don't give up on 3 until you get to the bottom of the Queensboro, because I know I'm a better downhill runner than an uphill runner. Sure enough, on the downhill of the Queensboro, coming down it, I passed a lot of people, and then I had a nice sort of second wind, or what turned out to be perhaps a dead cat bounce up First Avenue, which was a really classic New York City Marathon race, actually, where you feel the struggle up the Queensboro, you have a second wind on First Avenue, and then I just got annihilated in the Bronx. And the Bronx is where the wind was a real killer, because the buildings were not as high up there, I think, so we were more exposed, also running right into the teeth of the wind. And, you know, you're at mile 20, 21 anyways, a time when you're not going to feel that great. And at the 20-mile mark, I was an hour 18. And I thought, okay, I still have a shot at sub 3. But it was soon after that where I slowed down. The wind was really knocking me around. And I just couldn't. I couldn't sustain the pace that I had going up First Avenue. So finally, a teammate of ours, James Chalmers, James Charlton, said to me, I passed him at the 18-mile, right about 18 miles. And he says, hello. He says, how are you feeling? And I used a word I can't repeat on air here.
that's very telling.
But then I said, but that's all right. And I think that was kind of the mood of the race. You know, I think it was like that for many, many, many people. So many people after the race said it was a terrible race. I mean, the wind, last year it was windy, but it was nothing like this year windy. Last year, I think the winds were, I don't know, 15 miles an hour. This year, 25 miles an hour. That it makes a huge difference. So then, funnily enough, around mile as I'm entering Central Park, a few miles later, there's James coming again, and this time he's passing me, and he tried to urge me on to run with him, and I didn't have a response. I couldn't keep up with him, mind you. I wasn't quite roadkill. There was a lot of roadkill. That's people who are walking or people who are grabbing their legs and not even moving. Or people who are running really, really slowly. And that wasn't me. And I was still moving. I wasn't shuffling. I was still moving. But I just was moving a minute per mile slower than I had been earlier in the race. I think my slowest mile is 8:29, which is nothing for me to write home about. But interestingly, I was 2 minutes behind my time from, I think, 2011 when I ran the race, and then at the 20-mile mark, and I ended up beating my time from 2011 by 9 seconds. So even though I had a pretty bad fade in the last 10K, which was completely predictable given my training, I was able to hold it together a little bit better than I had in the past, and that saved the race for me in a sense. I mean, this isn't one that I'm really proud of, this one, but it was nice to notch my second best time on that course. One last impression from the big fade at the end. It had entered my mind. I didn't do it, but I did consider walking, and I considered crying. I think that's just how it went, you know. I didn't do either. Neither would have helped me. I'm sure both would have hurt me. It doesn't help to get too emotional in a negative sense during a race, and it doesn't help to walk generally, I don't think. I suppose on occasion it does, but for me that certainly wouldn't have helped. But it was just tough. It was tough out there.
Yeah.
And again, you know, my clear thought, very clear thought after race, this is for masochists. Now that said, so what is a positive spin on there? What's something I can take away from it? Well, I feel quite clearly that if I do a marathon next year, and I think I'll probably do a fall marathon, probably not a spring marathon, that I do want to arrange my training so that I go in there with a shot at a sub-3 and with a shot at a PR. And to do that, I will get in 3+ training runs of marathon pace at 15 miles or more, which is basically what some of our guests have recommended on the show, and 3+ 20-mile runs. Maybe some of those runs will be the same, and an average of 60+ miles per week for 10 weeks before the race. I know that that's what I need to get in the kind of shape to do it. Certainly it's not what everybody needs. It's what I need. It's probably more than what the average person does in training for a marathon, but certainly a lot less than what a professional would do training for a marathon. You know, 60 miles a week is nothing for them. They'd run a lot more. So at this stage of my life, I don't think I can expect to run sub-3 without that kind of training. Why I didn't do it this year, I don't know. I was coming off of two good marathons. Why I didn't do it this fall, I should say. I was coming off of two good marathons, and the run life, maybe I had too much run life balance, or I just need to find new places in my life where I can fit the running in. And one thought on that was, you know, I do have some vacation days at work. Maybe next year, if I train for a fall marathon, I'll use a few of those vacation days to, you know, get some things done, but also to do my 20-mile runs. Maybe taking a day off of work and just clearing some time to get that done might be better for me than hoping that I'll get it done Sunday night, and then Sunday night rolls around and, you know, I have time to do 2 hours of running, but not 3 hours of running.
Well, you said you're not proud of the race, but I'm proud of you, Brent. You did a great job given what you had. As Dina Castor often says, you got the best out of yourself on that day, given the conditions, and you were not roadkill.
Yeah, I think I got something out of myself given the conditions. The best, I don't know. If 3 hours hadn't been in my head, and if I'd gone in there a little bit more patient and not trying to sort of hit the jackpot, maybe I could have run a few minute or two better. I don't know. It wasn't a perfectly paced race, but I was happy about finishing it, especially given how we didn't finish that Boston. And this was, I learned the value of a medal, I think, on that day when I didn't finish Boston. Then I saw other people with the finisher medal. I never really cared about the finisher medal, but I thought, ooh, this kind of stings. They have one and I don't. So, so I do take a bit of pride in having just been out there and experienced the race on that day.
Yep. You know, about the 20 milers, and I clearly, knowing you, and we're in a similar situation with young children, it's really hard to find the time. And it's especially hard to find the time for dads or moms, because the weekend where you normally get your long runs, that's often the busiest time for parenting. And I think we all face that. It's hard to go out for three hours on a Sunday morning. So I think your idea of taking a select vacation day to get that done is a good one. And it's such an important part of training. If you think of training as a big scaffold, those long runs are the load bearing beams of the training. And you've certainly reminded me, as I'm just beginning my Dubai training, to not skimp on those. So I'll find a way. The other thing, thing you said, I just want to pick up on, and I really think it's important, is you said at one point, you said to yourself, don't give up. And you might think that that's sort of like a negative, not so positive thought. It actually is, I think, a positive thought because it says stay in the game. And I remember saying this to myself in Manchester because the first part of Manchester was a bit of a headwind. Conditions were much better than New York. I'm not comparing, but it was a headwind. And I knew that there would be a tailwind in the second half. And I said, just stay in the game. Don't give up. And it's kind of like psychologically thinking ahead and passing it off to your, you know, future self an hour or 2 hours down the road. You were thinking, don't give up. I may be feeling fine in the Bronx and I may be able to pick it up. And that's actually a good mental cue to not really be too worried about how you feel in the moment because things can change.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd say on the 20 milers, it's not only a time issue, it's a sort of a time / will issue because not only do you have to have the time, I mean, really, if I can do a 2-hour run, I should be able to do a 3-hour run and the universe isn't going to crumble. It's the will. It's the will to do it. Cause it takes a different kind of will to do a 20-mile run than to do a 12-mile run. For me, it's just, it's just a lot different. Let's see what happens at, you know, what you were just talking about, sort of having the patience to look ahead and recognizing the race, you might feel better at some point. That came with experience. I think the experience I had in running prior marathons, it certainly, it's not going to give you 10 minutes, but it might prevent, it's not going to give you 10 minutes where you don't deserve it, but it might prevent you from doing 10 minutes worse than you do deserve. I didn't panic.
That's right.
And then finally, we give a lot of race day advice here. We give a lot of advice on the show. So this was kind of this year, I think, has been a little bit of a do as I say, not as I do kind of year. Before Manchester, I think I was hitting it pretty well, but still not as well as before New York last year. And next year, hopefully, it'll be a do as I do as well. I'll try to really get in that groove again. And also, we gave a lot of advice on the last show, a lot of race day advice, given that it was too late to train. I think that was a good idea. And I did actually apply a lot of the advice that the pros had given us and that we got from Angela and Lauren in the race. I tried to stay in the moment, as Lauren had suggested. And I did try to smile, something I picked up from Esther Erb and also Desi La Linden in an interview shortly before the race on Competitor said that it's important to have fun. So I did try to smile periodically throughout the race, but Greg, they were fake smiles.
You could tell.
The only time I think I honestly smiled was there was this North Brooklyn runner, a guy named Sean, who turned to me at some point during the race and said, "Hi, Bren." And he's a friend of my sister's, and I was kind of startled. And I actually had been trying to keep up with him because we were just approaching the big North Brooklyn runners cheering table at mile 12 by McCarran Park. And I wanted to be next to him for that part of the race because I knew they would cheer for him. And I thought, well, if they cheer for him, you know, maybe someone will recognize me and cheer for me too, or I can draft off of his.
Like ducking under the water, you're ducking under his cheers.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, I think a fake smile is probably still better than the grimace.
Yeah. I agree. But it was a grim preceding that thing. Yep. I only had my third win didn't come until there was about 100 meters left, and I saw there was a chance that I could beat my time from 2011.
Right. All right. Well, congrats, Bren. And our favorite word is onward. Let's move onward. And by the way, I'll have something to say about that no spring marathon idea that you've got. Bren often calls me a pusher, as in a marathon pusher, like a drug pusher. And so I'll work on that, and we'll see if we can get him on the road earlier than a year from now. So
see about that. You who aren't doing a fall marathon.
Yeah, that was because of other things in my life. So I'm running one in January. I'm running one as early as I can in 2015.
Fair enough. All right, Greg, so you care to get on the soapbox?
So I've got a little soapbox. I do want to do, before I get to it, I do want to credit Tim Layden of SI for his soapbox. He wrote about Meb Keflezighi, and he said that Meb should be the Sportsman of the Year this year because of his amazing win at Boston. And so you can read that article. It's a good one. And boy, we harp on SI not having anyone on the cover representing running for decades. Sportsman of the Year would be pretty juicy. That would be pretty cool.
Yeah.
And certainly agree that Meb is deserving. So let's keep our fingers crossed. Hopefully SI listens to its writers. My soapbox is about racewalking, and it's not to make fun of racewalking at all. They're amazing athletes. We're not covering racewalking, and we don't have plans to, but something came into my email box. We get these press releases from the IAAF, and they ratify world records. It's sometimes peculiar how it takes them months to ratify a world record. I'm not sure what the process is, but just the other day, they ratified a world record in the 50K racewalk. From the, I think it was the European Championships in Zurich, Switzerland in August. And so racewalkers, I guess, don't, the official distance is not 42K, it's 50K. And a Frenchman named Johan Denis broke the world record with a 3:32:33, which is a lot of threes, a pretty cool time. It's also symmetrical, 3:32:33. Breaking the world record in the 50K racewalk by almost 2 minutes. The previous was 3:34 by Russian Denis. I'm not even going to try to say his last name. But it got me thinking, how fast is that? And I did a little easy calculation, converting 50K, just a straight division, making it into 42.194988K, which is the marathon distance. I wanted to be precise about this. And it turns out, Bren, it's a 2:59:22.
No kidding.
So there are two ways to look at this. You could be it could be inspiring, or it can be just infuriating.
So there are people people who walk 2:59.
Yeah, I'm like putting my life into trying to break three, and some dude can walk it. Well, I'm going to choose to not be miserable about that. I'm going to choose to focus on the positive and just say that that inspires me. It's pretty amazing that they can do that and run at that clip.
We got the race walkers going to come after us for this URL, Greg. Cloud 259.
Well, Johan, if you're listening, Johan, why don't you come to Dubai and pace me to 2:59:22? I'd be so pleased if you could do that. So that's my soapbox. It's a short one. Please, everyone, let us know about your maybe you already know about your spring marathon plans, or maybe you've got a race still to go in Philly or otherwise. Let us know. We've got the Strava team. We've got a Facebook page. We're on Twitter at cloud259.com. And do we have any other areas to reach? Oh, yeah, our email, cloud259@outlook.com.
Oh, everywhere. Facebook, Strava, Twitter. We're trying all the social medias. We even tried Instagram, but somebody has cloud259 on Instagram. So, yeah, if you have a catchy name for us, let us know, and we'll start an Instagram account too. And then there's that Google social media one. What's that called? Circles or something?
Google Plus. Or something?
Google Plus. Know. Yeah. See, no, we're novices at this stuff, but we're trying, people. We're trying to reach you. So reach us too, and we'd love to get your feedback and share your experiences on our show.
Well, special thanks to Desi Linden for joining us, Marathon Royalty. It was great to talk to her. And we will see you next time on Cloud 259, Running on Air.